Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, making friends with monsoons by gamifying climatology and painting as a pathway to self-awareness. But first, for a minute there, it looked like we were going to be sitting here this morning talking about how to navigate a shutdown of the state government. The legislature battled down to the wire on passing a budget, with negotiations pitting factions of the Republican Party against each other, as well as Governor Hobbs. But then, at the end of last week, a breakthrough compromise emerged. Governor Hobbs approved it, and the government is somehow funded. Now that the smoke is starting to clear, let's get a postmortem from KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez, who has been following every twist and turn down at the Capitol. Cameron, good morning.
Good morning.
You're a coffee drinker, right?
Oh, yeah.
Would you say you would conservatively estimate the number of cups you drank at, several thousand?
Yeah, I'd say that's about fair between myself and Wayne, my counterpart down at the Capitol, and plenty of takeout as well.
Yes, hat tip to KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky as well, who's also been all over this. So, Cameron, let's talk about some things that actually appear in the final budget that there is broad consensus is good for the state. Let's start with public safety.
I think that's definitely the main thing I've heard them talking about as a bipartisan win, because everyone wants to be on the side of public safety, and public safety has been saying that they needed raises, and they actually managed to accomplish that. So it's state firefighters, DPS, troopers, they're all getting raises. And there's also a bonus, although it's a one-time bonus, for corrections officers. And that, you know, they're obviously appreciative of it. The Republicans were crowing about it, and the Democrats are crowing about it, so everybody's happy. One of those rare things that everybody can be happy about. But Hobbs introduced it, I think, in her initial budget in January. So it's something that she's wanted from the beginning as well.
Okay. So this was something that was there from the beginning of talks and did end up in the final in the final form. There's also some money allocated for potential litigation around the Colorado River conversations. Tell us about that.
Well, it's interesting to me. It's not that much money. It's a few million dollars, which in the grand scheme of the $17.6 billion budget, you know, is small potatoes. But I think the concept of it is interesting because it means we're gearing up for war, basically, with these Colorado River negotiations going on. We're going to probably be hearing about it more and more and more as it becomes imminent. And we're negotiating in that as, you know, potentially in a bad position because we're going to be taking cuts most likely. And it's a question of, you know, how much and when. So we're potentially going to be going to court to defend whatever happens or prosecute whatever happens. And we're putting money aside for that now, which is something that had been suggested, I think, by Hobbs as well at the very beginning. So presumably, you know, not really a party line issue, but more of a let's look down the line and prepare for whatever may come.
Okay. And finally, another thing that it seems like there was some consensus on and a bit of a win for Governor Hobbs here is around child care.
Yeah. So in her initial budget, again, the one that she releases at the beginning of the session each year, she said that she wanted to fund child care very heavily. She said it's part of her what she calls the Arizona Promise program. And this budget does include that. Child care gets a new chunk of funding for there's basically a wait list for people who apply for child care assistance, and they're trying to fund that to cut the wait list down so that more families can get that. There's also money for foster care, things like that, which makes sense. Hobbs is a former social worker. This has been a priority of hers. She talks about it, and they were able to accomplish that. Some of the other things, of course, that she wanted that are more partisan, like restricting the ESA program, those didn't make it through. Those are, you know, private school vouchers. But those Democratic priorities didn't have a prayer.
Yeah. Well, so these are some things that, as you've been talking about, all sides involved were able to come together on a little bit. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that made it through into the final budget that surprised you, that seemed like there was no way it was going to get through and is somehow in there?
Honestly, not so much. Okay. I think that in all the various versions of the budget that we saw, there were plenty of things that surprised me. But in this particular budget, I think it makes sense. I think that there's some wins for both sides, but mm-hmm. nothing too crazy that the other side would get bashed for if they had to vote on it. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on who you talk to, obviously, because if you talk to the Democrats who are frustrated and voted no on the budget, they would say, you know, I can't believe that we're supporting this thing, or, you know, one of the big ones is that there's not enough for education, in their opinion. Yeah. And then vice versa, you know, the Republicans in one of the budgets that they put out, they wanted to put restrictions on the attorney general's office and expand the power of the county recorder, and none of that made it. So, no, yeah. But that's kind of what it's supposed to be like in a divided government.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of these, the tenor of comments like that once a budget gets passed are the kind of things you would expect to hear in any cycle, right? From, you know, there's always going to be a side that didn't get what they wanted that's going to be like, ah, it's a travesty that we're not funding this thing. But that does point back to, as you know, we've talked about here on the show and all across the station, this was a very contentious session. You've covered a number of these at this point. How would you characterize it in comparison to other sessions that you've covered?
I think at the beginning of this session, it didn't seem so crazy. But then at the end, it really ramped up and it ended in complete fireworks and chaos. And we weren't even sure what was going to happen with the state shutdown. There were rumors of a fourth budget, which made me want to cry. And I'm so glad that that didn't happen and that I'm here talking to you rather than down there talking to them right now. I think that the population of the legislature has changed a lot from my first session a few years ago, when there was a different leadership team, but also a different set of lawmakers. And there have been two election cycles since then. And I think a lot of it goes down to who these people are. And we, as you may recall, had an election in November of 2024.
Oh, did we?
So we've got a new team of people, and they're interesting characters, and they're kind of testing the waters. So I think it was really like a testament to that. End of the session.
Well, no tears, thankfully, for KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez. Cameron, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The latest BRICS summit takes place in Brazil on Sunday. BRICS is a coalition co-founded in 2009 by the nations of Brazil, Russia, India, and China. They were joined in 2010 by South Africa, hence the acronym BRICS. The coalition has since expanded to include many additional countries, but this year's summit looks like it will not include the leaders of some original member countries, specifically Russia and China. Joining me now to talk about this, as well as some other key stories from around the globe, is the BBC's Pete Ross. Pete, how is the reported absence of these two countries being received in Brazil?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Brazil has seen this as a bit of a snub. First of all, Chinese President Xi Jinping. Now, according to the South China Morning Post, he has decided not to attend. One of the reasons being put forward is that he has already met the Brazilian President, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, twice in the last year. However, why else might he not be attending? Well, there's been some speculation, again, according to the South China Morning Post, that the Brazilian President's invitation for another founding member to have a state dinner for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi could have sparked Mr. Xi's withdrawal, as it could have made the Chinese leader appear as a supporting actor. You know, optics, we hear this word a lot these days, how things look and how things appear. And certainly when you have global leaders on the world stage, it is all about how things look.
Right.
This is important, how they appear and how, you know, they're perceived in the public eye. The other leader who will not be, or who is likely, or we're told will not be in attendance on Sunday, is Russia's President Vladimir Putin. The reason for him not attending is perhaps a little more obvious. It's because there's an outstanding arrest warrant issued by the International Criminal Court, issued back in 2023, just a year after Russia launched its full-scale war against Ukraine, accusing Putin of war crimes. Reuters reported on Wednesday that this was the reason that Putin would not travel to Brazil. Commentators have suggested that perhaps the expected absence of President Xi and President Putin, beyond those reasons that I've given you already, could be an early signal or a sign that unity among the core members, the old core members of this group, which has expanded dramatically in recent times, is beginning to fray. So all eyes on Brazil to see what is discussed and, you know, how things might, you know, unravel there as regards the future of this group.
Well, speaking of politicians, Pete, Poland's Supreme Court is due to rule tomorrow on the validity of the recent presidential election there. This comes amid mounting pressure over the contested results that saw right-wing candidate Karol Nawrocki eventually winning a runoff. Many polls predicted him to lose. Tell us more here.
Yeah, the Polish elections held on the 1st of June were extremely close. You mentioned Karol Nawrocki there. He beat Liberal Warsaw Mayor Rafał Trzaskowski by a very narrow margin indeed. It was 50.89% to 49.11%. And yeah, that, I mean, it doesn't get much closer than that. And that has caused some, particularly obviously in the losers' camp, in Trzaskowski's camp, to question that. This is all highly contentious, not just around the vote itself, but also the Supreme Court chamber that's due to make its decision that should be announced on Tuesday. A significant point of contention is the legitimacy of that chamber, and a group of 28 Supreme Court judges have signed a letter declaring the chamber illegitimate. I think it's pertinent at this point to mention and to remind your listeners that Poland operates a semi-presidential system. So actually, you may have heard of Donald Tusk, Poland's prime minister.
Yes.
He's important to mention because they're kind of share power, the president and the prime minister. And he initially dismissed suggestions that members of his ruling coalition were trying to overturn the election result, and he was not calling for a recount himself. I think it's worth saying that Poland's president can veto legislation, and Nawrocki, who is a socially conservative supporter of US President Donald Trump and opposes a federal Europe and Ukraine's entry to NATO and the EU, is pretty much on the opposite side of the political spectrum of the man that he kind of essentially shares power with. So I think this is all to say that the political situation in Poland right now is very complicated, and it's unlikely to get less complicated with tomorrow's ruling.
Well, finally, Pete, let's go to France, where a ban on smoking in all outdoor places where children might be present came into effect on Sunday.
Yeah, zut alors. Apologies to all French listeners, French US listeners. But yeah, I think it is fair to say that France is a country that some might say is more synonymous with smoking than most. So this outdoor ban that came into effect on Sunday, perhaps raising a few eyebrows. As you say, it's a ban on smoking outdoors in all public places where children might be around. Anyone that smokes and is considering going to France this summer, you should be aware of this. The new rules are aimed at protecting children from the dangers of passive smoking, as France aims to be what the French government is describing a tobacco-free generation by 2032. Now, that means if you light up in the vicinity of, you know, in beaches, public parks, vicinity of libraries, swimming pools, schools, then you could be subject to a fine of 135 euros. That's around $160. Now, the one thing I would say about this is anti-tobacco activists are, of course, happy at this news, but they are not happy at the fact that the ban doesn't apply to electronic cigarettes, and anti-tobacco activists are not happy about this. However, as I say, I would think this is a pretty significant step. And again, just to say, according to a recent opinion survey, we might have in our minds that the French, you know, are more welcoming to smoking than perhaps, you know, parts of where you are, Sam, or where I'm speaking to you today. However, recent opinion polls say that 62% of people are in favour, and recent other polls have shown that people in France are cutting back on smoking quite dramatically.
The times, they are a-changin'. That is
Indeed.
The BBC's Pete Ross keeping us in the loop, as always. Pete, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Always a pleasure to be on.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what happens to your art when you choose to follow your gut?
There is no goal in mind. Maybe that's just playing with the colors and seeing how they bleed into one another and seeing some cool shapes that those shapes of water and color form.
We will get an inside look at One Phoenix Painter's intuitive creative process. But first, when wildfires were burning in and around LA earlier this year, Evacuation notices prompted many residents to leave their homes. Priceless artwork at the Getty Center, though, stayed put. That's because the museum was designed and built to withstand wildfire. But that is not the case for many museums. And as climate change has led to more severe weather and storms, many people in that world are thinking about how to save what's inside museums in the face of those kind of threats. That is one of the main themes of a novel from Aaron Caffel that came out earlier this year. Caffel is a Chicago-based science and nature writer and novelist. All the Water in the World deals with questions of historic preservation during a climate crisis and is set in part on the roof of the Museum of Natural History in New York City. My co-host, Mark Brody, spoke with Caffel earlier and asked what got her thinking about this kind of story.
Well, I've been a writer my whole life. That's all I've wanted to do since I was seven. And I also was raised by conservationists, and I'm the daughter of an EPA hydrogeologist. So I was raised with a lot of consciousness about climate collapse, climate change, ecosystemic crisis, and was coming at it from all sorts of different angles, songwriting, journalism, science journalism. And when I was a young mom to a small kid and I was a single parent, Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, which is where I was born and where a lot of my family still lived. And I had this new kind of fear that I don't think I had really been living with before, which was a real picture of what could happen to places that I knew and grew up in. And it was in talking to my godfather, who had spent a whole night after the storm trying to get the ocean water out of his daughter's basement, that I sat down after my kid was asleep and started writing this as a way to write through my own fears.
Wow. Did it work?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because I would imagine that this is the kind of thing that might further keep you up at night thinking about this.
Yeah, well, I was already up at night. And I, as I say, I was already the kind of person that, you know, was a bummer at dinner parties. because I was already immersed deeply in this world and thinking a lot about extinctions and getting, you know, newspaper clippings sent by my mom about what was further happening in the realm of ocean science. And so I was living with it already. And I didn't really have a way to answer a question which was really important to me at the time, and I think was kind of important to a transition in the environmental movement of, you know, how do we feel about hope? How do we feel about what comes after? How do we feel about what is coming? And what do we do in a worst case scenario? And for me, I felt like writing a small, vulnerable family with some disability issues into a catastrophe and seeing if I, as a writer, my unconscious, my creativity, believed that we would be coming out the other side, that a family like that would be working towards a future that they believed in. And if I could believe it on the page, then I felt like I could believe it in my own life. And in the course of those years writing that book, all I did was find more and more evidence of, you know, the human drive for survival and for the retention of all that matters to people in culture, in family, in each other.
It's kind of an interesting juxtaposition talking about how, you know, writing this book has helped you look to the future a little bit, because a big part of the book is, of course, people working to save elements and pieces of history. I'm curious how you think about, you know, using the past, thinking about the past and using and thinking about the future at the same time.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, especially as somebody who's kind of obsessed with natural history museums, which are not completely value neutral places, right? There's been lots of mistakes that have been made in the curation and collection of items over time in those institutions. But at the same time, I think of something like the story of the largest collection of the most intense scientific discovery of bird species in the world, which at the time was in the British Museum. And or one of the large museums in Britain, it might have been the Natural History Museum. And during World War II, during the Blitz, that collection was moved farther away from London so that it could be retained. And the reason to retain it was not just the historical record of all of those species and that intense global diversity of bird life, but also because there's a plan for a future day when scientists may need to access the information in those bird skins to be able to understand transformations and what's happening and even restoration. And I think you see that over and over again in the way that curators work to, yes, make an historical record, retain an historical record within the collections in a natural history museum, but then they're doing that so that it can be used by a future scientist they never may meet, working on a topic that they are going to be sort of handing the baton off to the next generation to find and discover. And I think that is a really interesting part to me of the way that curatorial relationships work, especially in natural history museums.
What kind of reaction and response has this book gotten from the scientists in your family?
You know, my mother has passed away, and so I don't actually have a chance to talk with her about the reception of it now. But when she did pass, what I found on her bookshelf was printer copies of all three of the previous drafts of the book that I had finished before the time of her death.
Oh, wow.
She was deeply invested in the story that I was telling. And, you know, I make this joke all the time, but the thing that we liked to do when we had time together was to watch big blockbuster movies where the scientists are the heroes. And I think she would have appreciated not only that, but also that, and this is something that I worked with her and a lot of other scientists on while I was writing the book, that the science and the curation and the larger questions were close enough to being right that if a scientist picked up the book, they wouldn't be taken out by bad science at the core of this thing, which is an adventure book, really, at its heart.
Yeah, I'm curious about your process of researching and writing the book, because as you say, you have a scientific background, you have scientific knowledge yourself, you've spent a lot of time in museums. I wonder how, like, the relationship between the knowledge that you brought to this experience meshed with the knowledge that you got from people with whom you interacted and maybe asked questions of to try to get more information to write the book.
Yeah, I mean, I am a research nerd and I love it. It's one of my very favorite things. And so, you know, as I was writing this book, I was also researching, you know, articles that I was writing for on other topics. I was researching the memoir, which was very invested in looking at the fastest warming marine ecosystem on the globe, which is the Gulf of Maine. And so, every interaction that I had with someone that I was looking at for those larger goals that I have as a science writer, as a nature writer, all of those I think showed up in the book and kind of were a breadcrumb trail.
Erin Caffell is a science and nature writer and novelist and author of the book All the Water in the World. The kinds of questions about preservation raised in Erin's book are among those being discussed at museums and cultural institutions around the world. For the past several years, those in northern Arizona have been working together to make plans to get important artifacts out of harm's way if there's some kind of emergency. Stacy Kristen is an archivist at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. When Mark spoke with her recently, he asked how Lowell has tried to formulate a plan without knowing what the emergency may be.
That's the problem. I mean, we have so many contingency plans, and yeah, sometimes when I'm looking at this, I'm like, oh, what if this happens? What if this happens? So we look at a few things. Obviously, we're up here in the middle of the forest, so fire is going to be a big issue with us, and then water damage, because those two go hand in hand. So we have plans regarding everything we can think of, but obviously when there's a disaster, something happens that you haven't thought of. You know, we've had in the past really mild earthquakes up here. Could we get a big earthquake? I don't know. You know what I mean? So what we do is we look at our collections, and we here at Lowell, we have papers and artifacts. And one of our the things we have that's unique to an observatory are glass plates that, you know, so if we get an earthquake, well, that's not going to be good for glass plates, but we don't really, you know, we can't worry about everything. So we've looked at what are the most important things we house here. And so for us, that would be like Percival Lowell's papers, the Pluto plates. We do have the Pluto plates in the repository here where we have everything else, the two plates that Clyde Tombaugh used to discover Pluto. You know, those are unique in the world. No one else has those. So we've looked at things like that and said, okay, you know, if the first responders come in and they say, you have a half an hour to get out whatever you can, what are the first things we're going to take? And so I think most institutions have done that in terms of looking at their collections and saying, okay, here's what comes out first, here's what comes out next, sort of like that, just prioritizing.
What is that process like? I would imagine it's in some ways like asking a parent to pick their favorite kid, right? Like you have all this stuff that you would love to have and you think is super important and super interesting and cool. But as you said, you know, first responders come and say, okay, you got half an hour to get what you can get and get out. Like, how do you, how do you prioritize that?
Right. So, well, we've prioritized in a few ways. Like I said, we would want Percival Lowell's papers. You know, he started everything. But then Clyde Tombaugh, he's the one who discovered Pluto.
Yeah.
We'd want his, you know. So what we've done personally here at Lowell is we've got a red and yellow dot system. So the boxes that need to come out first have red dots on them. The ones that can come out next have yellow dots. And it was just us sitting down and saying, well, what are our most important papers? What are our most important artifacts? You know, we've started trying to digitize as much as we can, but if we had the rest of our lives, we couldn't digitize everything that we have.
Right.
So again, we start with our most important collections. And, you know, if we have them digitized, at least we've saved the content. We want to save the actual, you know, the actual papers, the actual artifacts, just because that, you know, that's our history.
Yeah.
Like we see ourselves as stewards of history, right? And we're trying to preserve history for everyone. And sometimes I think about like how much of our history has been lost, you know, to things like water and fire and whatever, but we're just trying to have a plan. We have created a team of people here at Lowell that are willing to help us, you know, if we have to evacuate. And then we do have the other institutions. We have memorandums of understanding with these other institutions. So if it's a localized emergency, if it's just happening at Lowell, people from Klein Library, people from the Museum of Northern Arizona, you know, they're going to all come up here and help us. Mm-hmm. If it's happening all across the city, then we're on our own. But we have plans. We are working with a restoration company. And so they're going to come up and we're going to start doing drills 4 times a year. We've got all sorts of equipment to help us, you know, get our collections out. We've got a lot of PPE. So like, you know, maybe there's water in there, maybe there's soot and things from fire, whatever. So we have that kind of stuff. We've got wagons that have all terrain wheels so that if we put boxes in there and we have to pull them out through snow or water or mud or whatever, we can get things out. And it's just, you know, we're always thinking about it.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you're trying to prioritize what you would take and what you wouldn't, how much of a consideration is how easy or difficult an object is to transport?
Absolutely. I mean, when they had the museum fire here in 2019, Pioneer Museum literally could not take some things that they would have wanted to because they were too big. They couldn't just take them and put them in someone's car and get them out.
Yeah.
And so that's what we think about too. You know, if we had a limited amount of time, there are things here that we couldn't even attempt to take.
Yeah, I'm thinking about like you've a lot of telescopes, some very old historic telescopes. Like
yes.
I can't imagine trying to transport those, even if you had a lot of time.
No, I mean, when they do have to be transported, it is a huge ordeal. It's, you know, special equipment and a ton of people and people who know how to handle it and special boxes and foam all around it. It's not something that is easy to do at all.
Yeah. In the universe of things that concern you and that you think about, like, where does this fall about, you know, if there's some disaster, trying to get the stuff that you want to get out and how to do it and how much of it you can get out? Like, how much does this sort of occupy your thoughts and your time?
I mean, look, as an archivist, I have two main parts to my job: preserving history and making it accessible to people. So preserving it, I mean, this takes up a lot of my personal thought. I also have enough anxiety that this is the kind of thing I think about all the time. And I mean, I was a kid in the 70s, so I was raised on disaster movies. So, you know, I'm like, what would I do? What would I do? But also just, you know, you look at those fires they had in LA earlier this year. No one expected what happened, right? The way the winds made the everything jumping and all this stuff. So this does take up, for me personally, a fair amount of my mental energy. Also just because I live up here. And so we're getting close to fire season and it we had a really dry winter, you know, so everybody kind of has in their mind, like, what do you do? We wouldn't even try to take anything out of our library. We don't care. That can all be replaced. But the unique stuff is, you know, it's not anywhere else. And I worry about it sometimes, probably more than I should, but I do.
Stacey Kristen is an archivist at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Zach Guido is an assistant professor at the University of Arizona, and he leads the Southwest Monsoon Fantasy Forecasts, which are happening for the fifth time this year. Monsoons are celebrated in the Southwest, which Guido likes to say is a bit unusual. Typically, wild weather is not a good thing. But for the most part, monsoons are welcome. They bring rain, they lower temperatures, and they help control wildfires. Today is the last day to get in on the action for July's monsoon forecast, which is inspired by fantasy baseball leagues and March Madness. And Zach Guido joins me now to talk about how it all works. Zach, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Thank you for being here. So let's just talk first in a practical sense about how this contest works. Let's say somebody's listening to this, they want to get in on it. What do they do?
Right. Well, you can go online if you just Google search monsoon fantasy forecast. You'll likely find us. And we're just really asking the public for their best estimates of what monsoon precipitation will be like on a monthly level at five cities around the Southwest. It sort of circumnavigates the monsoon region here in the U.S. So that would be Tucson, Phoenix, Flagstaff, Albuquerque, and El Paso. And they make their estimates prior to the start of the month for that month at each site. And they score points based on how accurate their forecasts are in comparison to what actually fell in terms of rain. And also how risky their forecast is. So that's right. It's a combination of accuracy and riskiness.
Okay. Well, so Zach, tell me, you have a long-standing interest in Southwest climatology. You started a podcast, if I'm not mistaken, back in 2011 about this. What is so fascinating to you about climate in the Southwest in particular?
Well, first of all, it's just a great place to study the climate, and in particular the monsoon. It is a really variable phenomenon. It is unique to this part of the U.S. It brings relief to our heat season, which on a day like today, we really need. It also yes. quells our fire season. And it's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around. There's so many moving parts to it, which make forecasting it extremely difficult, particularly at timescales longer than a few days. So for me, it's just a way for me to look up at the sky and continually like stoke my curiosity about what's actually happening and why is the weather working in the way it's doing. And you know, each year I sort of learn something new. So it's interesting in that sense.
How predictable are monsoon seasons? Like, are there trends that you can look at and make an educated guess about these things, or do monsoons kind of have a mind of their own?
Well, a little, probably more a mind of their own than they do prediction. At longer time scales, let's say beyond a week,
okay.
It's hard to really accurately forecast what the monsoon will end up being. Will it be above average, below average, near average? There are some signals that you can use to sort of hedge your bets, but you know, we're on the northern fringes really of the monsoon climate pattern, and consequently we experience a lot of variability day to day, week to week, season to season, which makes sort of prediction a little bit challenging to do. So you know, right now the official forecast is sort of a shrug. Like, it could be above, could be below average. And, you know, that's really the impetus for this game. It's like you don't actually have to have, you don't need to have studied the weather for, you know, 20 years or a decade or so to have sort of privy knowledge about what it's going to do. Weather enthusiasts or, you know, novice themselves are probably as good of a forecaster as I am. So
interesting. Interesting. Yeah. How would you say our experience of the monsoon here in Phoenix compares to those other cities you were mentioning, Tucson, Flagstaff, Albuquerque, and El Paso? Does it manifest itself differently there?
Well, so Phoenix is a little bit later than, so I'm in Tucson. You know, Tucson has like probably twice the amount of rainfall, a little bit more than twice the amount of rainfall sort of at in the lower deserts than Phoenix does. So it's a more vigorous monsoon. It starts maybe a week earlier, but yeah. So Phoenix is drier. Obviously, it's warmer. Flagstaff experiences much more rain just because it's higher elevation. And as you go, generally, as you go north from the border with Mexico, the monsoon sort of signal attenuates a little bit. And there's some regional differences. Like Phoenix tends to get most of its moisture from the Gulf of California, whereas Tucson, you can get moisture from the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America, and as well as the Gulf of California. And so there are some regional features, but the main difference is in southern, southeast Arizona and Tucson, we get a little bit more precipitation, more rain days. But nonetheless, in Phoenix, you know, they also experience, you know, 2.5, close to 3 inches of rain. You get those days with widespread storms, like really gusty winds, you know, and cloud cover too. Like when there is moisture in the region, it like I said before, it sort of helps reduce that maximum temperature and provides a little bit of relief there. So yeah, there are spatial differences. But Phoenix experiences a monsoon just not as vigorously as Tucson does.
Okay, interesting. Well, get your predictions in, folks. That is Zach Guido, who is the leader of the 5th annual Southwest Monsoon Fantasy Forecast. Zach, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Capri Landi is a painter based here in the Valley. An exhibition of her work called In Phases is currently on view at ASU's downtown Phoenix campus. Looking at the paintings, I was struck by their expressionistic, almost mystical quality. And when I read up on Landi's process, I discovered that she practices a technique she refers to as intuitive painting. So last week, I invited her into the studio to talk about what that means, and she told me that a lot of it boils down to feeling an impulse and following it wherever it leads.
I may see a photograph, I may get a thought in my mind, and I'll just take it from there. And usually what I do is I work in watercolor. I really just kind of get wrapped in the flow of it all and just mixing colors or working with organic shapes.
You use the word flow, which I know is a reference to a very particular set of ideas about creative process.
Sure.
Like this idea of flow state,
yes.
Getting so immersed in something that you don't notice time going by. You said something about that once that I was really fascinated by. You said, the concept of flow is exactly what I feel when I go through my creative process, and the result of that flow is sometimes a tangible piece of art.
Correct.
Do I infer correctly from that what you are after is not necessarily a painting, but a state of mind?
That's correct. Sometimes you get a beautiful painting out of it, and there's something to hang up on the wall. There's a lot of things that I don't use and I don't share with anyone.
What is important to you about pursuing that state of mind, even if it doesn't lead to anything you end up wanting to share more broadly?
Well, I think as an introvert, I think it's a way of expressing myself, like my inner consciousness and things that are going on up in my mind. Those things are hard for me to express. And on the canvas or in the sketchbook, those are ways for me to explore those different ideas or to get lost in something and hide from the world for a while.
I'm gathering from what you're saying that sometimes these things that are in your mind that you want to externalize in some way aren't necessarily literal. They're not the kind of things you could put into words.
Correct.
But I have to imagine that you sometimes end up looking at what has resulted from your explorations on the canvas, and there is some concrete idea being reflected back at you.
Yes. Sometimes I'll be working in my sketchbook or I'll start a painting and I'll say, oh, this really looks like the rock formations at Papago Park, or this was reminds me of a time I was at the beach in Mexico and the way I felt. So it's a way of capturing maybe different memories or even processing maybe some not so nice feelings. Sure. And just kind of working through those things.
One of the things you have said is part of this dynamic for you is, to quote you, working with my inner critic. Tell me about that relationship. Not okay. To turn this into a therapy session, but...
That may be an entirely another show, but I think it's a way of being okay with different feelings that you're going through and not judging those.
Can you give us a sense, because I'm imagining somebody might be listening to this and thinking, That sounds so nice, the idea of externalizing these non-literal ideas that I have in my head but that are troubling me or affecting me in some way, shutting my inner critic up, making a painting, finding a way to process an emotional experience. I want to do all that, but how do I approach it practically? So could you walk us through... Capri's going to spend some time in the studio. How do you cultivate this state that leads to these outcomes in a very practical sense?
Okay. I would just literally go to the store, get a great sketchbook, pick out some colors you like. Watercolors are always nice because they're easy to work with in a small space. And I think they're very forgiving. Just mix the colors, throw it down, and let it go.
So much of what I hear you saying, Capri, is giving yourself permission to not have a goal. And yet, I've seen your work. It's very beautiful. It seems like in the course of doing this, you have developed a consistent craft. How did you start to recognize that these flow states you were cultivating were somewhat consistently leading you in a similar direction?
I think that the non-judgment thing is a huge element to this. I think the element of play. I think when I went to art school back in college, it was, we're going to set up this still life. We're going to observe how the light hits the different forms, and you're going to recreate this as realistic as possible. Well, this kind of throws out that idea, and it's quite the opposite, actually. It's just... there is no goal in mind. Maybe that's just playing with the colors and seeing how they bleed into one another and seeing some cool shapes that those shapes of water and color form.
You were saying at the beginning of this that a lot of times all you have when you begin working on something is some fragment of a memory or something you've been thinking about. Is there a consistency for you to those things? Do you find yourself often being drawn to memories of, you know, like places or people, or is it sometimes totally abstract, like just a feeling or something that you're trying to figure out what that feeling would look like?
All of the above.
Okay. So
as you're going through the play or as you're in the process, maybe some of those memories or feelings come to you while you're working, and that's completely normal, and you just kind of let it go. And that's my quote for this interview.
Let
I've
it
only
go.
Sent.
Yeah.
And what it will be, it will be.
Do you find that the impacts of working this way as a painter inform other elements of your life?
Yes. That's a hard one to elaborate on, but if I look at a body of work and I look at my old sketchbooks and even the show that I'm in right now, it's kind of like a soundtrack of different parts of my life, you know, happy, sad, lonely. Looking back at all of my work, those are some things that I see. But I don't think maybe the viewer would see that. And that's okay. Whatever the viewer would see, that's fine with me if that reminds them of a memory for them, or it makes them feel calm, or all of those things are all right. You know, when you get to a certain age, you're like, wow, we don't have much time left. This is not a dress rehearsal. I'm going to explore some different things.
Was that a significant realization for you, that idea of being on the clock?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. You know, life happens. And I'm also a very sensitive person. Don't tell anyone.
I do have to tell you, this will be broadcast publicly.
But I think that even more so, those times of experiencing flow and working with these different, you know, mediums and concepts and stuff like that, I think it becomes even more important.
I've been speaking with Capri Landy, who is an artist and an art educator. Capri, thank you.
Thank you, Sam. I'm really grateful to be here today.
Well, this is not a dress rehearsal, and it can be tempting to want to hide from the world, especially when it gives you, as Capri called them, those not-so-nice feelings. Here at the show, we hope we've helped the world make at least a little bit more sense on this Monday morning. Thanks for making us the soundtrack to your life, or at least part of it. We'll take another crack at it tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.
That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.